This is Digital Story Podcast number 1024, November 4th, 2025. Today's theme is My Favorite New Features in Lightroom 9. I'm Derek Story. Lightroom Desktop continues to vie for the hearts of enthusiast photographers who aren't already locked in to Lightroom Classic. And for those of us who want a more flexible solution, the terrific tweaks in version 9 bring it steps closer to becoming a total photo management and editing solution. I'll cover new features for both Classic and Desktop in today's TVS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. When Adobe added local file management to Lightroom Desktop in October 2023, I became far more interested in tapping it for photo shoots. The local tab makes it far more practical for those of us who prefer to organize our photos in the Finder instead of the cloud. Lightroom Desktop 9, just announced at Adobe Max, continues to meld cutting-edge AI tools with common-sense file management. The five new features that I'm most impressed with have a little AI and a dash of workflow sweetness. And I'm going to talk about some of those tools right now. Last week or the week before, I can't remember at the moment, where I was talking about DxO PhotoLab 9, which is what I'm going to use this week for the workshop with the OM3. And then, of course, at Adobe Max, they drop Lightroom 9, and with these terrific new features that I'm going to talk about today. And the reason why, you know, people ask me, well, why do you prefer Lightroom Desktop to Classic? Well, the short answer is I'm not already tied in the Classic. You know, it's hard when you're tied in the Classic to extract yourself from that version and then, you know, move into Desktop, you know, the newer version of Lightroom. The other reason, though, is that I like to use multiple applications, and I have to use multiple applications as part of what I do as a podcaster and a, you know, teacher and all those things that I do. Lightroom Desktop allows me to, again, point to that same set of images I have in the Finder that I can use with DxO PhotoLab 9, that I can use with Nitro, that I can use with On One. So it's really helpful to be able to go that route and not be locked into a database where I actually have to import pictures and do all that kind of stuff. And I think that's the essence of why I prefer Lightroom Desktop. Now, I stay up on Lightroom Classic. I do have Lightroom Classic. I don't use it for my work. But quite honestly, these days, whenever something new is introduced in terms of a tool, unless it's specific, like a couple of these things are today, to the evolving state of desktop, but the new AI tools and stuff, for the most part, are introduced to both Classic and Desktop. So I can continue to use Desktop and stay up on the tools that Classic users, you know, you might be one of them, are using too, and they work the same. So at any rate, Lightroom Desktop, Lightroom Classic, both terrific apps, and both are evolving at a very nice pace with some really good stuff. Let's take a look at some of these things, and I will call out if they're in Classic or Desktop or both in this podcast. I'm going to start with my favorite new feature, which is assisted culling. And this is in both Classic and Desktop, and I absolutely love this. Wedding and portrait photographers are going to go crazy. But honestly, anyone who takes a lot of people shots, like parents of toddlers, are going to appreciate this time-saving feature. In Desktop, whether you're in cloud mode or local viewing, assisted culling is now near the top of the left-hand column. Click on it to open your options, check the boxes that are important to you, and Lightroom goes to work. First time through, I turned everything on because, you know, that's the way I do it. Under Select, I checked Subject Focus, Eye Focus, and Eyes Open. I wanted it to be looking for all those things. I enabled them for the reject tool, documents, misfires and exposure issues. So I had, you know, the application looking out for good things and bad things both. What Lightroom does is it marks the proposed selects with a green check, and it marks the rejects with a red X. So you can copy the selects into the cloud, apply batch actions such as ratings and labels to both select group and the rejects group. All of this filtering work is done in seconds, saving, honestly, a huge amount of time. Now, it's likely more options will be added over time, enhancing its usefulness for other types of photography such as landscape. But even in its present early access state, this is a great addition. This is absolutely great. So I ran it on a couple photo shoots that I did, you know, portrait shoots. And I just love the way it found, you know, the eye closed shots, the way that it found things that were maybe slightly out of focus. It worked really well, and it was easy to take those shots, both the goods and the bads, and kind of separate them and do what I want with them. And I consider it, especially for portrait shoots, wedding shoots, I consider it now my first pass through, and it's much faster than I could do myself. And then I take the green checks, and then I do my first pass, which is a second pass, so I'm already ahead of the game. This is a terrific workflow tool, and I'm really happy about it. I love it, absolutely love it. Now for desktop users who want to use the local tab, and remember the local tab came to us, what, in October 2023. And that changed everything for me because I wasn't using what was called then Lightroom Creative Cloud very much because I wasn't thrilled about being tied to the cloud itself. I didn't want to pay for more cloud storage, all that kind of stuff. So the local storage option that they introduced in 23 was terrific. I'm going to mention some tools that make this a much better photo manager when you are using the local tab. So let's start out with show subfolders in local storage. And this is desktop only. Oh my gosh. I mean, I don't understand why this wasn't part of it from the start, but I use subfolders all the time. If I'm on a shoot for a week and I'm going to all these different stops, and let's say every day is a different location, then I'm using subfolders, and I divide each day into a subfolder, give it a name, so I can go straight to that day, and then I put them all in a master folder for the name of the trip, right? So Eastern Sierra, we just got back from that, so that would be the master folder, Eastern Sierra, and then I would have things like Convict Lake, Mono Lake, you know, all that kind of stuff as separate folders. Bodhi would be in its own folder. Well, before, in Lightroom Desktop, you could only see the pictures in a folder if you opened that particular folder. If you clicked on the master folder, you did not see pictures. Now they fixed that. So now when I click on Eastern Sierra, the master folder that has all these subfolders in it, I can see all of the pictures contained in the subfolders, or I could go to the individual subfolders themselves. I find this extremely useful for star rating. And now also color labels, which they also added in Lightroom Desktop. We now have color labels. We did not have them before. Color labels are terrific, and I use them all sorts of different ways. If I make a print of a shot, that's a color label. If a client prefers a shot, that gets a color label. Color labels allow me to mark images for specific purposes without messing up my star rating system. And that's what I really like about them. And now we have them in Lightroom Desktop 9 as well. Thank you very much for giving both of those things, both the subfolders and the color labels. Also, we have batch file renaming in Desktop now. And this is fantastic because it allows you to rename the files with these great tools in Lightroom, but yet it renames them at the Finder level. So if you have Lightroom, right? Let's say that you have Lightroom Classic and you also have Lightroom Desktop, right? Because you got the photography plan and you're not using Desktop very much because you have Classic, but this could be a scenario where you use Desktop just for one purpose, for batch file name renaming. It works super well. I've tested this a number of times. So instead of just going IMG underscore 2222, Now you can do IMG222, the name of the location, the date. You could put all that stuff in the file name, and you see it in Lightroom Desktop, and you'll also see it at the Finder level. Way cool. Thank you very much. I'm just so happy to have this. And then finally, these are the five that I like. Now, in the next story, I'm going to talk about one that I think a lot of other people are going to like as well, but we'll get to that in a minute. But these are my five favorites. And the fifth one is remove dust spots. And this is both in Classic and Desktop. AI-powered dust removal feature in the distraction removal panel automatically detects and removes dust spots in a photo created by dust on your camera sensor. Click on the remove icon on the right side of the interface, go down the panel to the distraction removal, and you'll see that you now have a dust option in addition to people and reflections. Click apply under dust, and Lightroom detects and removes those pesky sensor dust marks. Talk about a time saver. I mean, really, here. Oh, I mean, just going through images and looking for dust spots. And, you know, let's say that you had a day where you changed lenses and some debris got on your sensor. And then suddenly you're seeing all this dust show up in the sky on your shots. And you're just bummed about all the work you have to do. No more. All you do is just run this tool. It will take care of those dust spots for you and let you get back to the things that you want to do, like making the photo better instead of fixing the things that, you know, went wrong, often not really your fault. So removing dust spots automatically in both Classic and Desktop, I just think is another one of those really good, logical, common sense tools that they've added to Lightroom. Lightroom Desktop is evolving nicely, and I've really noticed it in the last two versions. Thanks to improvements in the local tab, it's now useful for people who like to use, you know, different applications and point them all to a set of images in their Finder, you know, whether it's in the pictures folder or if it's on a removable drive, wherever it happens to be. Plus, you still get, you know, all the AI enhanced features that Lightroom Classic people are getting too. So it's a tremendous step forward, Lightroom 9. I just think that they've done an excellent job with this version. I'm very happy with it. And as a result, I'm going to be using it more. And, you know, I can decide when I put a photo shoot in the Finder here, what do I want to use? You know, what do I want to do with these shots? Well, maybe it's going to be a Lightroom 9 shoot. Maybe it's going to be a DxO9 shoot. Maybe I'm going to work on it with Nitro and send them up the photos. It's great having Lightroom Desktop in that set of options because there are so many good tools in there. And sometimes, you know, one of those tools can just save you a whole bunch of effort. Good job, Adobe, on this latest version. Let's get to a little bit of camera industry news. I got a couple stories for you here. I have a few stories for you here. Let's keep it going with Lightroom. This is on Digital Camera World. Lightroom has a new slider, and it's a game changer for fixing red skin. Meet the new color variance tool. And I have a link to this story in the show notes that's on Digital Camera World. Let me read you what they have to say. As a photographer who has photographed more than a few weddings in 90-degree heat, I've edited my fair share of red skin, but Lightroom just added a new slider that's going to make correcting red skin far faster, color variance. There are a handful of new tools in Lightroom October 2025 update that I'm particularly excited about as a portrait and wedding photographer, and color variance is one of them. It's a slider that creates more or less variety in a selected color tone. Using the color variance slider, photo editors can make a selected color range more uniform or take the slider in the opposite direction to add more color contrast. That makes the tool useful for smoothing out color variations in skin tones, such as redness from heat. But the slider can also be used in the opposite direction and create more color contrast in landscapes and other shots. Color variance is located in the Point Color tool, which is available on Lightroom Desktop and Lightroom Classic. The new tool can be applied to an entire image or to a mask, such as applying the change only to the skin tone. Like all Lightroom sliders, you probably don't want to take the variance slider all the way to the right or to the left. Variance is a bit more subtle, but it makes a noticeable difference in editing skin or working to add contrast. Color variance can be used in conjunction with other point color sliders. That includes the range slider. Range dictates how many colors similar to the one you selected are also impacted by the point color sliders. So if you want to adjust more or fewer colors with color variance, adjust the range. Excellent, and this is new in this latest version for both desktop and classic users. Affinity, going the DaVinci Resolve route, is brilliant and a proven success. This is an article on Petapixel. I have a link in the show notes. Today, Affinity announced that it was going free to use for everyone, a move that probably surprised a lot of you because it was certainly unexpected to me. However, the more I think about it, the more it makes perfect sense. Affinity is never going to beat Adobe in paid capacity, but there is one company that has already proven it can topple the giant by offering an alternative for free, DaVinci Resolve. Since it went free to use, Blackmagic has slowly eaten away at Premiere Pro's market share among creative professionals and over the last few years has become the de facto editing platform for just about everyone, largely because it's great, but also because it's free. Resolve didn't start out as free, similar to the situation at Affinity when Blackmagic purchased it in 2010. It kept a one-time purchase pricing model that it inherited. For a year, Resolve cost almost $1,000 for a license, but by 2011, Blackmagic realized that that was a barrier to entry that most users were never going to jump into. In June 2011, Blackmagic introduced a light version that was free. It held back features to paid tier, but the base software was there. Over to the next decade, Blackmagic continued to make the value proposition of Resolve, especially the free version, stronger. Today, DaVinci Resolve gives editors access to almost everything they would need at no cost. There is still a paid tier, but it only unlocks support for resolutions beyond 4K, exported frame rates up to 120 frames per second, 10-bit video processing, multiple GPU acceleration, HDR grading, collaboration tools, and additional plugins and AI-driven features. Most content creators don't need any of those things, so most DaVinci Resolve users do not pay for the studio upgrade. Now, DaVinci Resolve is so good and so popular, it has become impossible for its competitors to ignore. While Blackmagic doesn't publish user numbers, third-party platforms report that Resolve has exploded in popularity, growing from just 900 users in 2009 to over 5.47 million in 2023. Anecdotally, Petapixel has noted a huge swing in users migrating from Adobe Premiere Pro, and most creators are either using Final Cut Pro or Resolve now. While Premiere Pro didn't help itself with widespread reports of regular crashing around 5 years ago, the main issue can be tied to cost. Premiere Pro is expensive. Adobe charges $23 a month to access the app by itself and $70 a month to get it bundled with the full 20-plus app suite. As mentioned, Resolve is free, and even if a user wanted to buy Studio, that's just $325. That's the price of just over a year of renting the software from Adobe, but Resolve licenses are perpetual. That's what makes Canva's approach with Affinity so smart. The strategy here is basically the same. Offer the base software with the majority of features to anyone who wants it for nothing. And then if specific AI-powered features are desired, those can be added on with Canva at $15 per month. The fact that Canva doesn't offer perpetual license is really the only difference in strategy, and it remains to be seen if that's going to be a major blocker to Affinity's widespread success. But the rest is already proven to work. What Affinity needs to invest in for photographers right away is a robust RAW editing platform and huge profile support. Adobe has regularly been the king of this and continues to support photographers faster than any other platform. Even Apple is comically slow at adding RAW support. It took the company almost a decade to add the OM System EM1 Mark II camera to RAW support list and over a year to add popular Sony cameras. Affinity can't rely on Apple, Microsoft, or anyone else to support RAWs. The company needs to invest in relationships with camera brands and make swift additions of new cameras and lenses with regularity. But one thing is clear, everything is in place for Affinity to finally succeed and pose a real threat to the status quo. So this is interesting. It's an interesting move. I haven't played with Affinity for a while, mainly because, well, it's like Photoshop. And I don't use Photoshop very much either. So there we go. But I like their strategy here, and I'm going to follow this story to see if it works out for them. I know that we have people show up at the workshops who do like Affinity. I'm going to ask them, what do you think of this new strategy? I think it's going to be popular, and hopefully it attracts some new users, especially people who want those basic tools, those basic Photoshop tools, but don't want to be tied to any sort of subscription or even a perpetual license fee. Very interesting move by Canva. Pentax bet everything on photographers coming back to DSLRs. Now what? This is an article on F-stoppers. I have a link in the show notes. In 2019, when every other camera manufacturer was embroiled in the race to develop mirrorless systems, a Ricoh executive said something truly remarkable. After 1 or 2 years, some users who changed their system from DSLR to mirrorless will come back to DSLR again. He went further, predicting that the DSLR market is currently decreasing a little bit, but 1 to 2 years or 3 years later, it will begin to get higher. It has been 6 years. His prediction, optimistic as it was, didn't pan out. In fact, it was impressively wrong. But here's the thing. Pentax is still here, still making DSLRs, still existing in a reality the rest of the industry abandoned somewhere around 2018. This isn't a story about a company making smart pivots or reading market trends correctly. It's a story about a company that chose a hill to die on and somehow hasn't died yet. This is kind of fun. Now, you guys know that I am a fan of Pentax cameras. I have a few, and I love the lenses as well. And I shoot with my Pentax KP on a regular basis. And I like using the older Pentax lenses on my digital cameras. One of the reasons why I like Pentax, one of the reasons I like Nikon, is using those older lenses on the newer bodies. So let's continue with this story. The DSLR commitment nobody asked for. Let's start with the obvious. Canon stopped developing new DSLRs. Nikon stopped developing new DSLRs. Sony abandoned their A-mount DSLR line to focus entirely on mirrorless. Pentax is literally the only company still all in on this technology, not hedging their bets, not maintaining a legacy line while focusing on mirrorless, all in, completely committed, the last believer standing. Their current lineup tells the story. The K1 Mark II, a full-frame flagship, launched in 2018. The K3 Mark III, their APS-C flagship, came out in 2021. A handful of entry-level bodies are still in production. Pentax confirmed in late 2023 that the new APS-C DSLR is in development, though no release timeline has been announced. No public roadmap, just vague assurances that development continues. This is it. This is the fleet. But then we have the Ricoh GR, the only thing that they got right. If you want to understand how weird Pentax's situation is, look at the Ricoh GR3 and the GR4. These pocket-sized cameras with fixed lenses and APS-C sensors are everywhere in street photography circles. TikTok photographers love them. This is the Pentax Ricoh actual successful product, their one unambiguous win in the modern camera market. The GR proves something important. Ricoh can read the market when they want to. They understand that compact, discreet, no-nonsense design works. They get that photographers want tools that don't draw attention, that fit in the pocket, that do one thing really well instead of trying to be everything to everyone. The GR embodies the same design philosophy that Pentax claims drives their DSLR commitment. Simple, durable, focused on the essentials. So why does it work for the GR and not the K-mount? The question nobody at Ricoh will answer is this: if the GR works, why not apply that thinking to interchangeable lens cameras? Why not make a GR-style mirrorless K-mount camera that carries over the same ethos? The answer is simpler than you think. They already tried. In 2012, Pentax released the K01, a mirrorless camera that used the existing K-mount. This was exactly what K-mount users claimed to want, a mirrorless body compatible with decades of K-mount lenses. The problem was keeping the K-mount's flange distance meant that the camera body had to be awkwardly thick, negating most of the size advantages of mirrorless. Pentax compounded this thing by hiring designer Mark Newsom to create a bizarre brick-like industrial design that looked more like a concept piece than a working camera. The K01 sold poorly and was discontinued after about 2 years. So when people ask why Pentax doesn't make a mirrorless K-mount camera, the answer is they did, and it sold poorly. The lesson they learned wasn't try again with a better design. The lesson they learned was K-mount and mirrorless don't mix. Instead, the GR exists in a completely separate universe from the K-mount DSLRs, as if they were made by different companies with different philosophies. Maybe they are at this point. And then he talks about the Pentax 17, the film camera that they came out with. Again, it's cool. I genuinely respect it. It's charming, well-designed, and fills a real gap in the market. But it's not a business strategy. It's a love letter. They're making cameras for a world they wished existed, not the world that actually exists. And that's been Pentax's problem all along. There's a lot to this article, and like I said, the link's in the notes if you want to read all of it. But let me finish up with the last two paragraphs here. In 2019, Pentax expressed their belief that photographers would come back to DSLRs in 1 or 2 years. It was optimistic speculation, not market analysis. 6 years later, they haven't. The DSLR market didn't stabilize. It collapsed. Mirrorless didn't fade. It won completely. And Pentax is still here, still making DSLRs, still believing. That's either the most admirable commitment in the camera industry or the most expensive act of denial. Probably both. They chose a hill to die on, and they're dying on it with dignity. Making excellent cameras, few want. There's still something almost noble about being that wrong with that much conviction. But nobility doesn't pay the bills, and conviction doesn't ship units. Pentax bet everything on photographers caring about the same things they cared about. The market said no, and now they're out of moves. Pentax probably has 5 to 10 years more of inertia. The question is whether that counts as survival or just a very slow ending, or if they pull off a miracle. No matter what, they'll go down in history as a company that believed so hard in DSLRs they couldn't see the world changing around them. Sometimes being good at making cameras isn't enough. Sometimes you have to make cameras that people actually want to buy. I just watched the World Series, and believe me, this is connected to Pentax. I just watched the World Series. It was possibly the best World Series I can remember in modern history, and I can't tell you how many times the Dodgers reminded me of Pentax just being down and out. It looked like the game was over, and then somehow they pulled it out. It was just crazy to watch. It was two fantastic teams, both the Toronto Blue Jays and the Los Angeles Dodgers, just going at it, Dodgers on the ropes, and then finding a way to survive and ultimately winning the World Series in extra innings, Game 7. I'm not saying that Pentax are the Dodgers of the camera industry, but I do know this. When Toronto got an early 3-0 lead in Game 7, I did not turn off the TV. Even though their pitching is excellent, and even though it looked like they had a true leg up on winning the World Series that night, I just knew better. There's something about baseball that just keeps me watching no matter what. I'm going to keep watching Pentax as well. I haven't bought any new cameras from them for a while, but I'm still using the ones I have. Maybe they will fade away, maybe not, but I'm not ready to write them off quite yet. All right, stick here with a little virtual camera club news. Boy, this is a workshop week, and I'm going to get to see some more Inner Circle members. I'm so excited about this. Inner Circle members, they're the people that support this community month in and month out, and I'm so happy to be working with them, so happy to see their comments online, so happy to have them show up to workshops. This is a great group of people, and if you want to become part of this group and join in the online activities, the online workshops, the physical workshops, just be a part of people who see the world in a very similar way that you do. All you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, nose around a bit, sign up, and the next thing you know, you'll be getting an invite to our Inner Circle site on Derek Story Online. I hope you do, because I think you will truly enjoy yourself. And a big thanks to Inner Circle members for supporting this podcast. And finally, I'd like to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. I started doing some printing from the Eastern Sierra, and I have to tell you, the hardest part of the whole process for me was deciding what to print, you know, because I had so many good candidates. Now, the reason why I mention that is the hardest part wasn't making the print, because I have Red River Paper and I have all the information that they have on their site. I have great paper and I know how to make a good print. Thank you, Red River Paper, for that. So they've moved the printing equation from knowing what settings to make and what to do to deciding what to print. That is what we say is a good problem to have. And that's the kind of information that Red River Paper provides in addition to the fantastic stock that they make available. If you want to learn more about printing and move your problem from deciding how to make a good print to deciding what to print, then click on the Red River Paper tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, nose around a bit, and then next thing you know, you will be printing some of your favorite images and sharing them with the world. A big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm going to be enjoying our Inner Circle members this week in Sonoma. We're going to have a great time, but I'll be back with another podcast next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.